between creation and evolution, and then talking about the need for addressing this issue. First of all, creation is taught in the scriptures. That's the kind of creation we all believe. Portrays the world as complete. God finished his work in 6 days. It was the result of a supernatural agency, which of course is revealed to us in the scriptures. The term catastrophism refers to the geology of this finished creation. Changes in the earth have been the result of catastrophes, and in particular, the flood of Noah's day. Creationism, as taught in the scriptures, teaches that the earth is the product of intelligent design and all the life that is in it as well. Creationism asserts that life begets life, and finally, that order is decreasing. In other words, the universe is winding down. It's like a garment that was once new, but is growing or waxing old. On the other hand, let us look at evolution. We could go into the implications of this a great deal more than I have time to, but slide the chart back down there so I can get up here. The evolutionist believes that the processes that made this world are still going on. He believes that they are naturalistic. There is no superior mind. There is no God behind them. He believes in uniformitarianism. The same things that made the canyons and made the mountains are going on today that went on, in his estimation, millions of years ago. Of course, catastrophism allows for a rather short period, which the Bible teaches. Uniformitarianism requires millions and even billions of years. The evolutionist position says that it's all the result, ultimately, of chance and accident. Fortuitous, but nonetheless, chance and accident. Ultimately, the evolutionist has to believe that dead, inert matter gave rise to living organisms or living cells. And I believe that it is right here where we can really nail evolutionary philosophy, and we will try to do so. Order is increasing. Things are getting better and better. And humanity, as well as the rest of the world, is actually climbing toward some higher form of life. This, in fact, is contrary to observation and experience. Next chart, please. Now, we need to discuss this issue today because it is involved in some of the most critical questions that you and I will have to ask and answer in our lifetimes. Our whole life philosophy, the way that we lead our lives, is going to be based on how we answer these three questions. Where did I come from? Why am I here? And where am I going? Now, the creationist says, I was made in the image of God. Genesis 1, verse 26. Genesis 2, verse 7. God has put me here for a reason. My purpose for being here is to live according to his will, to fulfill his good pleasure. And where am I going? I have a date with, I have a date with destiny. I am headed for judgment. And after that, either eternal heaven or eternal hell. Your answer to the first question, where did I come from? How did I get here? Is going to affect your answer to the last two. Now, in schools today, and this is something that many of you never had to face because you were already out of school before it ever came into the public school system of our country. In schools today, your children or grandchildren are being told in ways subtle and not so subtle that the way they got in this old world is by chance and accident, by evolution. And of course, this opens the floodgates to all kinds of influences and philosophy that is materialistic, naturalistic, rationalistic, and anti-supernatural. In other words, it is propagandizing them away from the idea of God, revelation, and all the things that we hold dear. That's why this is something that needs to be addressed. We need, as parents, primarily to prepare ourselves to teach our children and to equip them to deal with what they are facing in the schools. Let's go to the next chart, please. Now, here is just a brief chart that I don't have time to go through all of it, but I want to point out that biblical creation teaches that God created the spiritual and the physical universe. Space, matter, energy, and time all had a beginning. This is taught in the first two chapters of Genesis, a couple of the chapters in the Bible that are the most attacked, because it is the first two chapters of Genesis that lays the framework, lays the foundation for all that follows. If Satan can destroy confidence in God as our creator and our moral governor, then he doesn't have to convince us that baptism is not essential to salvation. He doesn't have to convince us about some of the other false doctrines that people are believing to their soul's destruction today. If he can just destroy confidence in God, his battle's already won. The Bible teaches that Jesus, when the Gospel of John begins, it portrays that Jesus was God, was with God in the beginning. He created. He was a part of the creative agency of God. In Exodus chapter 20, where the law, the Decalogue is given, the Ten Commandments, there where the fourth commandment was given, remember the Sabbath to keep it holy, for in 6 days God created heaven and earth, and on the seventh day he rested. The fact that God created, and by right of creation, is the moral governor and father of the universe, is the basis upon which obedience is appealed for. Now, the implication also of the fact that all of this had a beginning is that it also is going to have an end. And I think this is what the evolutionist wants to do away with more than anything. The idea that one day he is going to have to give an account. He's going to have to be responsible for the choices that he's made in this life. We've already heard some good things taught us by way of informing us about New Age philosophy. Basically where everybody's responsible to themselves and themselves only, without reference to some outside authority. The fact of the matter is, we will all stand one day and give account of the things that we've done in this body, whether they be good or evil. 2 Corinthians 5 and verse 10. But the Bible teaches that the heavens and earth, which now are like a garment going to be folded up one day and cast aside. And of course, this is back in 2 Peter chapter 3 and verse 10 as well. We hasten along. I'm going to consider, this is where I gave a talk a couple of years ago at Wichita Falls, and this is basically where we left off. I talked about the philosophy of evolution and upon its pernicious influence in our world today. Some of the very things that we're struggling with in our homes and the schools and society at large are the result of the evolutionary philosophy. I don't think it is the boogeyman that's caused all of our problems. That would be overstating it grossly. But the fact of the matter is, God-denying philosophy, which has as its rational basis the fact that man is an organism that has pretty well just come about from a simple organism to a higher organism. He's just an animal, and he can take care of his own affairs. There's no one to whom he can look for help. There's no one to whom he will one day be accountable to. All of this has Darwinian evolution as its foundation. And so I just put that up to familiarize you with it once again. Now we're going to begin by considering the two propositions we're supposed to address. Can science be harmonized with Scripture? I'll consider that last. And now I want to talk about some of the things that your children, if you're a student in school right now, you will face. First of all, you will face the contention from biology teachers and many others as well that evolution is a scientifically proven fact. My little girl's in fourth grade. Now, in 1956, they began in the state of California teaching evolution in the high schools. So I got a good dose of it. It was not until 1968, and it was not until the 1970s, that the teaching of evolution was actually legalized in some states. In 1968, the Supreme Court overturned the law in Arkansas that forbade the teaching of evolution. About 12 years later, they overturned another law that was that was put on the books to try to get creation taught alongside of evolution. But the tables have completely turned in about 20 years' time. Today, evolution is what must be taught. It is mandated by state law. It is mandated by regulations that are a part of the regulatory power of the Department of Education and our federal government. Well, today we've got the situation where children are taught in many different ways the theory of evolution and its implications. When I went to open house, my little girl's in fourth grade, and looked at her textbooks, I found three different textbooks that had a strong dose of evolutionary philosophy. Now, one of these was a reading book. It was just a reading book, a language arts book. But there was a section in it. This was the non-fiction section, it said. The title of this section was Dinosauring. And it was a bunch of stories written by scientists about dinosaurs. This is the nonfiction section, set in big letters right at the top of that section. Nonfiction reading. Of course, they had other stories in a little English book that were fictional. You know, maybe like Cinderella or Goldilocks and the Three Bears. You know, those are fictional. But now here, this section, these little children are being subtly told, this is nonfiction. This is fact. You know, if you don't believe this, then you don't believe in George Washington. That kind of idea is being put across. And then she has a book on Missouri history. Fortunately, her teacher is a lady who goes to a, she's very strong in a local denomination, and she won't teach the first chapter of the book. She didn't have to. But the first chapter of the book has nothing to do with Missouri history. All it's about is cavemen and evolution and the fact that man has been around for, lo, these millions of years. Now, I'm getting off on a little tangent here, but let me point out that you heard a few years ago about the Louisiana law in which they tried to mandate, as the Arkansas did, mandate that creation had to be taught alongside evolution. Well, it was overturned. But the evolutionists, the ACLU in particular, has tried to portray that as a victory for science and reason. In fact, it has proven to be a victory for creationism in the schools to a certain degree. One of the decisions that was handed down was, you can't force an evolutionist to teach creation. And conversely, you cannot force a person who believes in creation to teach evolution. And so we hope that decision will stand. That people who conscientiously believe that evolution is false will not be made to teach it. But anyway, that's getting away from the main subject. The whole point is, in those two textbooks, and in the third, which is her science textbook, and which obviously has some of the rudimentary doctrines of evolutionary philosophy in it, my little girl is getting a healthy dose, at least 6 years in advance of when I got it in high school. She's getting a healthy dose of a philosophy that could lead to unbelief and infidelity. Now, when I was in high school, that certainly gave me a problem. I just did not accept. I just did not accept without critical examination, without thinking about it, whatever my teacher said. But at the same time, I was unaware that there were really answers, good answers, that were available to show that evolution was not scientifically sound. Let me talk now for a while about the fact that the evolutionists themselves admit that they cannot produce the evidence that the enemies of evolution require. Here's a fellow by the name of Theodore Dobzhansky. He's one of the leading evolutionists in recent times. And he says, these evolutionary happenings are unique, unrepeatable, and irreversible. It is as impossible to turn a land vertebrate into a fish as it is to effect a reverse transformation. The applicability of the experimental method to the study of such unique historical processes is severely restricted before all else by the time intervals involved, which far exceed the lifetime of any human experimenter. And yet it is just such impossibility that is demanded by anti-evolutionists when they ask for proofs of evolution, which they would magnanimously accept. Here we have the admission from a leading evolutionist himself that it is absolutely impossible to prove. Now, there are two main tenets to the evolutionary theory. One of these is the theory of natural selection, or also called survival of the fittest. These are the twin, this and the theory of beneficial mutations are the two legs upon which evolution walks. But there are many difficulties with both of these sub-theories of the general theory of evolution. First of all, an important difficulty of survival of the fittest is simply that supposedly over a vast period of time, characteristics and organisms evolved because they were more fit for survival. But an important difficulty is that useful characteristics would be liabilities instead of assets while still in an uncompleted state of development. For example, take the flying squirrel. Now, the flying squirrel, according to most evolutionists, just didn't have enough loose skin that he could glide through the air as the modern flying squirrel does. At what point did some flying squirrel finally have enough loose skin where he could sail from the trees without falling like a dead weight and bashing himself into the ground? Another example would be the bombardier beetle. Now, the bombardier beetle is a little creature that is an amazing little chemist. It defends itself from birds and other would-be predators by emitting an explosion that startles and even burns those creatures that would eat it. You can hear a distinct popping sound when the bombardier beetle defends itself. Now, this bombardier beetle has two glands with an inner and outer compartment. The large inner compartment is where he stores the two chemicals that are used to create this explosion, hydroquinone and hydrogen peroxide. And this is what he uses to defend himself. He actually creates an explosion by the chemical, by bringing these two elements, these two chemicals together, and mixing an enzyme, kind of a trigger mechanism or chemical, with them. Now, the question is, how many bombardier beetles blew themselves all to pieces before one of them finally just got it right? How many of them actually did not make it? Well, you see the whole point that we're getting at here. We are simply talking about the fact that natural selection, because of the very fact that it is supposed to give rise to complex organisms, just doesn't make sense, because these complex organisms, in the cases that we've noticed, aren't accountable by natural selection. Another thing, and this was pointed out by Alfred Wallace, I'm not going to be able to cover every point on every chart that I'll put up here, but one thing that Alfred Wallace, who was a compatriot and supporter of Charles Darwin, one thing Alfred Wallace pointed out as a potential problem for the theory of evolution is that human intelligence was uniform, regardless of which race that a person came from. Now, if you go back and look in some of the old evolutionary texts, they actually taught that the different races of men represented different stages of evolutionary development in the human family. I've got a chart with me. I haven't put it in the books that we're going to see here. But it shows from a textbook back around the 1900s, a fellow by the name of Ridpath wrote it up, how that the different races of men represented different stages of progress in human development. But Alfred Wallace, when he went into the jungles of Africa, and when he went to Australasia and visited New Guinea and Australia, he found that the people there were just as intelligent, given the chance for education, just as educatable as 19th century Englishmen. And he, in fact, wrote to Darwin and shared his concerns with him. Darwin wrote a large no on his letter and underlined it three times. He wrote back to Wallace, "I differ grievously from you and I'm very sorry for it." He took a very unscientific attitude, you see. He did not attempt to answer Wallace's argument or consider it. His reaction was purely emotional. Now, I covered the intellectual and anti-theistic bias of Darwin and his early supporters in an earlier talk that I gave at Wichita Falls. And that is published in the 1987 Preacher Study Notes, The History and the Impact of Evolution. So I won't delve into that right here. But these men were not honest, open-minded men seeking for the truth. Many have argued from the complexity of such organisms as the human brain, the human eye, and so much else in nature, the impossibility of the theory of natural selection to account for this complexity of organization. Scientists have worked hard for years using the most advanced equipment available to build for our nuclear submarines advanced sonar capability. That took intelligence, that took effort and work. And still our sonar doesn't even come within 100 leagues of the sonar of the dolphin or certain other creatures in God's creation. One's chance an accident and the other the result of hundreds of millions of dollars spent by our Pentagon. Of course not. The next thing we want to consider, more to the next chart, is the fact that the theory of beneficial mutations likewise does not hold up under close scrutiny. I'm going to hurry over this very quickly and not even look at my notes, but I want to simply point out that the whole idea that there can be beneficial mutations is totally bankrupt. And yet that's what your children, that's what I was taught was true. Beneficial mutations have occurred. Now, by the admission of evolutionary scientists, beneficial mutations are extremely rare. But scientific observation has never documented a single beneficial mutation. Now, what is the scientific method all about? What is science all about? You know, the Apostle Paul warned Timothy over there in 1 Timothy, the 6th chapter, beginning of verse 21, rather verse 20. O Timothy, keep that which is committed to thy trust, avoiding profane and vain babblings and oppositions of science, falsely so called. I know he was referring to Gnosticism there. But there have always, in every generation, been people who claim to have knowledge that was superior to that which could be revealed in God's will. And we face a similar situation with this evolutionary philosophy. The word science simply means knowledge. Now, how do you get knowledge? You get it three ways. You observe, you experiment, and of course, you can receive it by instruction. Now, let me illustrate. I have two children. I tell my children, don't get near the stove, you'll get burned. There's instruction. But Natalie doesn't pay attention. She goes over, gets too close, touches the stove, and she gets burned. Well, she learns by experience that you cannot touch the stove. Nate, standing back a ways and sees her get burned, by observation he learns, don't get too near the stove, you'll get burned. That's how we learn. That's knowledge. That's how we get facts. Now, science, true science, is simply that which is observable and experimentally verifiable. If when we understand this, then we can understand that the theory of evolution is just that, a theory, a philosophy, a hypothesis that is unproven and unprovable. Now, talk about beneficial mutations. There has never been any observation of any such creature. Now, they've tried to create beneficial mutations. They've bombarded the common fruit fly for over a quarter of a million generations with X-rays and gamma rays and alpha rays and beta rays and everything they could think of to try to make it transmute into something else. And they've created fruit flies without wings and without eyes and without legs and all kinds of negative mutations, but they've never once created a beneficial mutation. Scientists have learned that mutations are weaker than their parents, and mutations die out because they cannot reproduce themselves, and so the two legs of evolution are crippled. Now, this is an example right here of the fact that we can point within that I don't believe that this is true. I don't believe that bats have been around for 50 millions of years or that the cockroach has been around for 250 millions of years. But I just want you to see that within evolutionary textbooks, within their doctrine itself, there is inconsistency because they will actually claim that these creatures that we've got listed here have been around for millions and millions of years without any change or transformation. Go on to the next chart, please. That's one thing a lot of young people are never told. They always get the impression that the evolutionary philosophy is a monolithic giant that brooks no criticism. All you have to do is look at some of their journals, and there's an ongoing debate. The whole theory is in flux and change all the time. Within their own ranks, they're constantly disagreeing. Now, here's some of the alleged evidence for evolution. Vestigial organs, recapitulation, comparative studies, and the fossil record. I'm only going to take time to look at a couple of these. Vestigial organs was an argument that was used, and the recapitulation argument, back around the turn of the century, with telling effect. Many people were convinced. These have since been discredited. Vestigial organs are supposedly from earlier ancestors and are no longer needed in the human constitution. And man's knowledge of the human body has increased, the list of vestigial organs has decreased to nothing, however. The appendix, the tonsil, and other parts of the body which were once claimed to be vestiges of our evolutionary forebears are now known to have a definite part in our human constitutions. Now, I can lose a hand and it won't bring my life to an end, but that doesn't mean my hand is without purpose. I can lose my tonsils or my appendix. I can lose other parts of my body, and I will lose my life, but that doesn't mean that they aren't without purpose. Today, while the tonsils and appendix were once thought to be useless leftovers of our evolutionary past, today we know that they are a part of that system in our body that fights infection. And, of course, all of the so-called organs that were once considered vestigial organs are now classified as a part of human physiology that is necessary for our health and well-being as much as possible. Let's go to the next chart here. Now, here is a chart that was used by Ernst Haeckel. This is from Ritland's book that I mentioned earlier, published around the turn of the century. in which we see supposed proof for man's evolutionary development. Here we see the fetuses of different animals showing the common plan of nature. And he has here a tortoise, a chick, a dog, and a human being. Now these four illustrations are supposed to show that although the tortoise and the chick and the dog and the human being are now quite separated from the evolutionary tree once they reach maturity, as they pass through the fetus stage, they are very similar because we all have a similar ancestry in the evolutionary scheme of things. Now that was the contention of Ernst Haeckel and of those who use the recapitulation theory. In other words, they're saying that while we're growing in our mother's womb, we recapitulate, we go back over all of our evolutionary history. There's only one problem with that, not the next chart yet. Only one problem with this, folks. All these pictures here, the whole idea put out by Ernst Haeckel was a fraud. It was a deceit. He invented the pictures. Here's a quotation from Sir Arthur Keith in his book, The Human Body. Now that the appearance of the embryo at all stages is known, the general feeling is one of disappointment. The human embryo in no stage is anthropoid in its appearance. Doesn't look like an ape. We no longer believe, says Frings and Frings in Concepts of Zoology, we no longer believe that we can read in the embryonic development of an individual its evolutionary development. Haeckel was a fraud, and the whole so-called evidence for evolution has been cast overboard. Let's skip by similarity arguments and go straight to the fossil record. This is where a lot of young people have trouble. There's a general agreement among scientists, evolutionary scientists, that their best evidence is in the fossil record. And claims are made for the fossil record that I believe are absolutely unsupportable. Carl Dunbar, in his Historical Geology, said, although the comparative study of living animals and plants may give very convincing circumstantial evidence, fossils provide the historical documentary evidence that life has evolved from simple to more complex forms. Now, there's the bold claim. There's the statement that your children are taught, that I was taught. The fossil record, all those dinosaur bones and bones of ancient cavemen, there's the proof that evolution is true. But evolutionists portray the fossil record as being supportive of their theory, despite the fact, now here's the important thing, despite the fact the fossil record shows no evidence of transitional species or missing links. For a long time, this was considered to be the fault of the incompleteness of the fossil record. That was Darwin's contention. But after 150 years, there has been no filling in of the gaps. There are still marked gaps between the various families of life found in the fossil record. G.G. Simpson had this admission. It is a feature of the fossil record that most taxa appear abruptly. They are not, as a rule, and I would even delete the phrase as a rule, led up to by a sequence of almost imperceptibly changing forerunners, such as Darwin believed should be usual in evolution. Now we can see that the fossil record does not support the evolutionary claims because today new theories are being proposed to explain why there are gaps in the fossil record. Maybe you were taught that the fossil record proves evolution. Well, then why are they coming up with these explanations for the gaps in the fossil record? One of these theories is the theory of saltation. It comes from a Latin word that simply means jumps. A fellow by the name of Schindewolf and another by the name of Goldschmidt came out with this explanation back in the 1930s. And it received a lot of ridicule. It was held to be disreputable. But today it's made a comeback because the evolutionary expectation that the fossils would one day be found, proving transformation from one species to another, has not been forthcoming. And so they're falling back on saltation. What is saltation? Well, it's simply this. One day a reptile laid an egg and out popped a bird. Now, you don't have to provide evidence. You don't have to provide fossil evidence if that's your position. But again, my people, look at the facts. Look at what we can see. Is this observable, experimentally verifiable science? No, it is not. But people like Bill Honig and others who are responsible for putting their textbooks under our children's noses are insistent, they are adamant, that evolution is as proven of a fact as the roundness of the earth. When in fact, if you look at the thing as it really is, it is not.
And why do people want to believe evolution?
I've only hinted at that, but if you read the earlier article in the 1987 Preacher Study Notes, I believe that it is simply a case of people don't love the truth. People reject the truth. They reject the knowledge of God. In every age and time, men have had some rationale to try to settle their minds and also to propagandize those who are perhaps immature in knowledge and faith. And this is the danger of evolution today. Let's go on to the next chart.
Missing number two.
Okay, go back to that chart. I want to take a look at this real quick. This is the so-called missing links. Now these are, if you look in the Time Life series on life, there is a volume on evolution, and there will be a chart in there showing these different men, obviously getting better and better looking by today's standards, supposedly the precursors of modern man. Ramapithecus is there. But you know, the evidence for Ramapithecus consists of a piece of the skull bone, part of the jawbone, and a few teeth. And yet it is this creature that is considered by many evolutionary scientists to be the precursor of man. But now it's considered by many of these same evolutionists. Remember, they're not all unified in the way they talk about things and look at things. Many consider him to be nothing more than a name. Australopithecus. And there are several examples of Australopithecus that have been found in the world. Walikis were involved in promoting this fellow as a missing link. Many evolutionists, however, now consider this to be an extinct ape. Now, one thing, you know, we hear a lot from the National Geographic Society about Richard Leakey and what he's doing to try to prove human evolution. But I want to point out that the National Geographic Society and Richard Leakey are on the opposite side of the fence from a bunch of other evolutionists who believe that the origins of man are found elsewhere. So, you know, they're a disagreement in their own camp. They don't agree on the so-called facts that they want our children to believe. Well, how can they be credible in that instance? Today, it is believed that Java man, based upon a simple skull cap, is simply a giant gibbon. In fact, in the very same grapple bars in which Java man was found, they also found a fellow by the name of Wajik man. This Wajik man proved to be nothing more than an eastern version of Cro-Magnon. And Cro-Magnon man is considered today to be fully human, a diseased human being, but nonetheless fully human. And it is believed today that Wajik man had Java man for lunch. Since Java man was simply a giant gibbon, he was a creature that was killed by Wajik man, a real human being, and eaten. Piltdown man was an absolute hoax. The English scientists who perpetrated this hoax apparently did not want the attention to escape to other parts of the world for the missing links that would be the precursor of modern man. This hoax remained undiscovered for 40 years. There's some good books on the subject. Entertaining and interesting to see how the people who were supposedly rational and disinterested scientists in the pursuit of truth can actually be given to such ploys as this. Nebraska Man. I've actually seen a picture of Nebraska Man, an artist's rendition, which no doubt had a very impressive effect upon lots of young people back, 50, 60 years ago. Maybe had a telling effect in convincing them that evolution was true. You know, the evidence for this so-called Nebraska man, the entire evidence consisted of a tooth that was later to be determined to be a pig's tooth, the tooth of a peccary, which is a variety of extinct pig. One tooth, and that artist came up with this beautiful rendition of this ape-like looking character to convince people that he was one of the missing links. Well, of course, that kind of thing is nonsense. Go on. Scantiest possible evidence. Peking man, now believed to be the remains of monkeys or baboons killed and eaten by workers in an ancient lime-burning quarry. Neanderthal man, now considered to be fully human, individual suffered from rickets. The Bible does have something to say about cavemen. You know what the Bible has to say about cavemen? The Bible tells us that those who went and dwelt in caves were people who were on the run for one reason or another. This is not a case of one time, men did not have the skill to build their own dwellings, but eventually evolved that skill as their intelligence evolved. No, we can find in Genesis 19 and 30 that when people were in distressed or reduced circumstances, they would often resort to caves for protection. Or if they were on the run from law, whether they were just or unjustly accused of breaking the law, they would hide in caves. Genesis 19, verse 30 records that Lot and his daughters went up and dwelt in a cave near Zoar.
1 Kings 18 and verse 4. It was so when Jezebel cut off the prophets of the Lord that Obadiah took 100 prophets and hid them by 50 in a cave and fed them with bread and water. 1 Samuel 22 verse 1 and 2 records how David fled to the cave Adullam. Up in Missouri there's a cave where Jesse James used to hide out. When people are on the run for their lives, or when people are in reduced circumstances and cannot provide for themselves, they go resort to the caves. And it is believed today that these so-called cave people of Europe, the Cro-Magnons and the Neanderthals, were simply people who were on the edges of human society, maybe people who have been cast out of towns and villages because of leprosy, rickets, or some other deforming diseases, and simply resorted to those places where they could find shelter and protection. And so don't let your kids and don't let yourselves be misled about all kinds of claims for the cave. I'm just going to hasten on. I'm going to go right past some of this stuff. Don't have time to go into all of this. But now I want to talk about harmonizing science and the Bible. I've got some charts here on some of the classical arguments for the existence of God, the teleological argument, the cosmological argument, and the anthropological argument. But now, this is an interesting area of study, and I'd recommend it to anybody. If you have any questions, then share them with me in your question and answer period. And I want to talk about some of the arguments from science that back up the Bible's claims. Now, people tell you that science and the Bible cannot be harmonized, and to a degree that is so. The fact is, the theories of science and the facts of the Bible, truths that the Bible reveals, may conflict. They certainly may. And theories of the Bible and the facts of science may conflict. You know, the Roman Catholics once held the idea that the earth was the center of the universe. Well, the Bible never taught that. That was their church dogma, but the Bible didn't teach that. But people will sometimes throw that up in our faces and say, well, you see, there's an example of where people believe the wrong thing because of the Bible. No, that wasn't the case whatsoever. But the facts of science and the facts of the Bible do not conflict. True science is the thinking of God's thoughts after him, as one man said. Jesus said in John 3 and verse 12, if I have told you of earthly things and you believe not, how shall I tell you of spiritual things? The whole point is, if the Bible cannot be trusted, if the Bible proves itself uncreditable in areas where we can check its veracity, then it cannot be trusted in the spiritual realm. And yet people will sometimes claim that, well, the Bible's not a book of science. It wasn't given to teach us anything about science. It has spiritual truth that is true. Its facts of history, its facts of science may be warped and bent and may not be true at all, but it's a book of spiritual truth. Well, what Jesus said proves that it cannot be a book of spiritual truth if, where it touches on the realm of nature, it cannot be trusted or proven to be right. So let us consider some of the evidence that the scriptures, in fact, teach us about scientific truth that would have certainly been unknowable to people 2,000 years ago, except a revelation from God. The first two things I want to point out are the first and second laws of thermodynamics. Energy can neither be created or destroyed is a succinct way of stating the first. This harmonizes with Genesis 2 and 2. God ended the work which he had made. The second law of thermodynamics says energy is becoming more disorganized and less available for work. This harmonizes with Isaiah 51 verse 6. The heavens shall vanish away, the earth shall wax old like a garment. The fact of the matter is, to just put it as simply as I can, these two laws of science, universally observable and demonstrably true, tell us that the universe is like a clock that has been wound up and it is winding down. Energy is becoming less and less available. So who put it there in the first place? Who wound the clock up? That is the enigma. That's the problem posed by these laws of science that the evolutionist cannot deal with. He's got a serious problem there. Now, for a creationist, that's not a problem. We can explain the universe because we say, as the scriptures reveal, it had a creator. It had one greater than itself. The material universe, even though it is vast and wonderful in its dimensions, had a creator who was greater than it. And here's the really wonderful and sobering truth. The one who made the stars made you and me. And you know, when you give that up and you believe that you're just an animal, it's little wonder that Johnny can't tell right from wrong, because it's the natural end result of some of the things that we talked about last night, some of the things that we're talking about here. The simple fact of the matter is, when you ship God as a moral governor of the universe out of your life, you are shipping out the anchor of your soul. You are casting away all that will keep society whole and will provide some hope of redemption for mankind. But now, getting back to the first and second law of thermodynamics, this harmonizes with what Scripture reveals. Oh, it is not in scientific language. This is certainly true. But once the universe had been created, its processes were designed to operate in an orderly fashion. All the different phenomena of nature and life were sustained by the forces that God put into motion. The forces, space, time, energy, matter. No further creation was contemplated for the present. God ended the work which He made. And this cessation of creative activity has been recognized by modern science in its formulation of the first law of thermodynamics. And it is also seen in the second law of thermodynamics as revealed as a result of the fall of man. The universe is now under the bondage of corruption, and all is waxing old and decaying as a garment. Let's turn our attention now to the next law. Now, you said, I said earlier that I was going to really hammer evolution on this principle right here. Spontaneous generation versus biogenesis. Ultimately, the evolutionist must believe in spontaneous generation, for the evolutionist must accept that non-living matter gave rise to living matter at some time in the remote past. However, demonstrable, experimentally verifiable, observable science. Now remember, that's what science is. That's what knowledge is. What you can see, touch, taste, feel, observe. What can be proven by the human senses. Now, what this shows is that science has proven that life begets life. Now, some of the leading biologists, men who were believers in God in the past hundreds of years, men like Louis Pasteur and Rudolf Virchow, accepted this scientific truth. Every biologist today accepts it as a fact. Every living thing arises from a previously existing living thing. Or every cell arises from a pre-existing cell. That takes you back to the old argument of the chicken or the egg, which came first. And from an evolutionary standpoint, you can't argue either one with any sense. If you take a creationist standpoint, then you can argue, as the scriptures reveal, God created the chicken first, like He created the man first, and all the other creatures in His creation, and put within them the seed to reproduce themselves. That's what the scriptures reveal. Now, that's what science observes. Life begets life. But evolution says that ultimately dead, inert matter had to give rise to life. Now tell me, which of those is the more believable? Which of those is the more credible? Ultimately, God, who is alive, alive eternally, acted in creation to create every living organism. Sure, He is supernatural life, but He is the originator of natural life. But that is consistent with the whole principle, life begets life. On the other hand, chance and accident, over billions of years, fortuitously combining to finally result in one living cell. Now listen, you hear people today talking about creating life in a lab. You know what they're doing? They're creating amino acids by passing high charges of electricity through ammonia and methane gases. They're trying to create rudimentary amino acids. Now, the difference between an amino acid and a protein is like the difference between a brick and a large building made of brick. Like the difference between a piece of steel, or iron ore even, and the great skyscraper that one day is constructed of that steel. That's the difference between an amino acid and a protein, which is composed of amino acids. Now, a living cell is composed of protein. But the difference between a protein and a living cell is greater even than the difference between iron ore and a steel skyscraper. But when you hear people talk about creating life in the lab, then you are hearing something that is absolutely impossible for man to do. He may create some of the constituent building blocks that, if properly organized by an all-intelligent mind, could give life, but he is not creating life. Besides, the whole idea is ridiculous. Creating life in a laboratory to prove evolution, all you've proven is that intelligence and design is necessary to create life. My time is out, and I haven't even hardly got into what all that I wanted to present. I wanted to talk about some of the negative and positive indications of the Bible's scientific accuracy. I've got some good books up here with me, and I can also recommend periodicals to any who might be interested. I've got a short bibliography here, and you're welcome to help yourself to it, to help get you pointed toward some material that will prove helpful to you. As I close my remarks, I want to say one thing. Galen mentioned last night that when he had children at home and was dealing with some of these things, then he went and bought some books, and then he was able to answer many of his children's questions, provide them with the evidence for the reasonableness and truth of the Bible story. Let me tell you a little story. You know, I've struggled ever since sophomore biology with the whole conflict between evolution and creation in my own mind. I didn't want to talk about it much, but I was still struggling with it. You know, I adopted for a while the position that a lot of people do on this issue. Well, maybe they're both true. At church, I believe in creation. At school, I believe in evolution. That kind of double thing. It was a problem for me, and it kept surfacing all the time. When you really get down to it, it's an either-or proposition. You cannot try to seek some middle ground. Evolution is God-denying, and it is anti-theistic in all of its implications. On the other hand, creation demands obedience to a loving Creator God who requires us to obey Him as a child, its father. Well, you know, that double-mindedness can create all kinds of problems, and it was in my case. It just happened, through some rather strange circumstances, that I visited Galen's home when I was 18 years of age, traveling with Paul Nichols. And as a result of an accident, we went there. And I just happened to be rummaging around, coming out of the bathroom and seeing a part of his library, saw a stack of books about Yehi, books on creationism, books answering a lot of the questions that I had. I didn't even know that there was such a thing in print, that anybody had ever attempted to tackle evolution. I just figured it was something you just had to reject because the Bible said it was, you know, not true.